Live from Dreerber, this is the Locked Tomb Podcast. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
Today we're covering chapters 4 through 6 and the flashback chapter John 5:20 of Nona the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. Before we get started, don't forget to check out the Locked Tomb Series Creator Hub on our website at locktombpod.com/fanmerch to support artists in the Locked Tomb fandom community.
Yes, and if you would like to support us here at the Locked Tomb Pod, you can find stickers, pins, and magnets on our website, locktombpod.com. By the time this episode is published, it will be 2023, which is wild. But you can still request a personalized holiday card from us if you want. It can be a belated holiday card, or it can just be a card for someone's B-Day or just because. So that option will still be up on our Ko-fi. Your support has helped us cover some of our expenses here at the pod, so we are so grateful, and it's been really fun to get those out to y'all.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. It is so nice to not have to worry about covering all of this ourselves.
Yeah.
So, moving right along, this section of Nona closes out day one of the 5 days that this book covers. In this section, we cover most of those bullet points that were underneath the day one cover page. So we cover Hot Sauce is Watchful, The City Has a Bad Day, and Nona Gets a Bedtime Story.
Yeah, and I think someone wrote in and was like, y'all spent a full hour on two chapters, which I can't believe, and yet it was good. Thanks. So we also couldn't believe how much time we spent on two chapters. So today we are covering four chapters. And they're juicy, so we're excited to get into it.
Yeah, buckle up.
All right, but before we get started...
oh, God.
I have a really bad joke for you. I'm having some trouble. I have been writing unique jokes for the holiday cards, and I said they would be personalized, which means that I'm not doing them on the podcast. They are very specific for the person who's getting the card. So... I'm a little joked out, but here's what I've got for you today.
I can already tell this is going to be chaotic as hell.
What does Hot Sauce put in her hair every day?
What?
Angel.
What the fuck? All right. Well, you know what? I thought, given that you literally just came up with that, I thought it would be a lot worse. You're a joke guy.
I will do better next. Maybe you should tell the jokes.
Yay. All right. Well, all right. Let's get right into it. So we jump right into chapter four. This is the bit that basically covers the Hot Sauce is Watchful bullet point. Mm-hmm. We're continuing with the morning routine. Cam, Pyrrha, and Nona leave for work/school. They cut through the park and Pyrrha breaks off. Cam walks Nona the rest of the way to the school and they see the cages in the park where they burn, you know, supposed necromancers, which is pretty bleak.
Yeah. And as Pyrrha breaks off from Cam and Nona, they both say good hunting to each other. And I know we had a little bit of a debate in the last episode around like, what exactly are Cam and Pal doing? What are they looking for? I think, you know, they're just looking for the sixth house oversight body. That's, you know, my theory. Mm-hmm. And then later on when Nona asks Cam, you know, what she was doing, Cam just says seeing people.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, what do you think that's about?
I don't know. I don't know if she's just trying to, if Cam and Pal are just trying to gather intelligence on where the sixth house oversight board is. Maybe they're also gathering intelligence on the barracks, but they're also doing crimes. I don't know if they're also stealing so that they can all eat. I don't really know. But I think probably the main thing they're doing is looking for the sixth house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so while they're doing that, Nona is at school, and when she gets to school, Hot Sauce is there early, which is not typical, and Hot Sauce is basically like, yo, there's someone watching the school from a nearby building, and Nona doesn't know what's going on, and it doesn't seem like Hot Sauce really has any idea of who's watching the school. She just knows something is up. Mm-hmm. I assume that Blood of Eden is watching the school. I'm pretty sure that it's Merv Wing, just from events that happen later. Mm-hmm. But do you think they're there for the messenger or for Nona?
I was thinking about this, and I think it's either... You know how Pash is sort of the messenger's bodyguard, escort? Yeah. I was thinking it could be Pash. Later, yeah. I think that body or person in the alleyway could be Pash, or it could be Mervwing. I feel like if it's Mervwing, they're probably looking for... They're watching Nona, and if it's Ctesiphon Wing or Pash or whatever, it's more of like a bodyguard for the messenger sort of situation.
Yeah. Hot Sauce does say something here like, when Nona's like, are they watching me? Hot Sauce is like, well, they were here before you, so probably not. So maybe they're just keeping an eye on the messenger, but we don't really know just yet. But during the rest of the school day, Nona's pretty distracted. There's a reference to her, you know, looking at herself in the mirror when she takes a tiny to the bathroom, and she's remembering that, you know, she's admiring herself in the mirror saying, oh, like, I'm so beautiful. And then she has this memory of Palamides telling her that her hair is falling out, that she has white spots on her nails. And I think this is the first hint we see that Nona's body is dying.
Yeah, I think so too. And then soon after that, so school starts, the angel arrives, she's looking very, very haggard. And the gang is kind of having this conversation about the angel. They decide that she's not hungover because Hatsa says she doesn't drink. But then they start to talk about how they think Nona looks unwell and has looked unwell for the past couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So we are getting some hints here that Nona, although she's like super into herself, is maybe not looking super great to people outside. Of herself.
It's so funny because we can pretty much trust Nona's assessment of everyone's emotions around her, but we can't totally trust Nona's interpretation of her looks fully. Everyone else is like, you look bad.
Yeah.
And Nona's just like, I'm hot. Which, you know what? More power to you. But
yeah.
I did want to mention, we don't have to go so into it, but I really enjoyed the description of the angel in this section. And they talk about how the angel wears like suspenders and a button down. And I was just like, this is a gay.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I feel like the angel is a good old fashioned dyke.
Yeah.
No
angel
doubt.
Is really dykey. But yeah, I liked the description of the angel. I haven't seen a ton of fan art of the angel, but I did see one. I think I retweeted it at one point and I really loved it. But if there's anyone who has drawn the angel, send that our way, because I do really love this description.
Yeah, I really, this, you know, whatever, third time through this book, I really like the angel more and more each time I read it too. So I've been noticing her more.
Yeah.
We move on. The gang is still talking, and Honesty says he's got a job later in the tunnels. He doesn't really elaborate, but that'll come back later. And then the Hour of Science arrives, and when Nona goes to take Noodle out for his walk, Hot Sauce tells Nona to stay near the school. I think Hot Sauce is a little bit spooked by this person watching them. And this is when Nona sees, she's near the school and she's hanging out with Noodle, and she sees someone sitting in a chair in the alleyway, but you know, they all have face masks. So you can't see, she can't see if they're alive or dead. And this is when I was wondering if it was Pash, like literally just bodyguard vibes on the messenger, but it could certainly be someone from Mervwing too.
Yeah, I think it's Pash. Because it's like one person really close by. And later on, when they get into trouble, Pash kind of bolts through like she's been there the whole time. I didn't even think that much about this section of the chapter until I reread it like for a fifth time.
Yes.
And I was like, no, I think that's Pash. Because, you know, also later when Pash comes in, when they're having their like conversation with We Suffer, Pash is sort of described in a similar way. So I'm going to say I think it's Pash, but you know, who knows?
Yeah, there are a couple other references later with the radio thing that we can talk about whether it seems like that's what's going on. That's the end of chapter 4.
Yeah.
And we move on to chapter 5. In chapter 5, it's mostly Nona and Palamides having a conversation about sort of the Blood of Eden characters, so Crown, the Captain, Not that the captain is Blood of Eden, but we suffer. And then they talk about the blue light, and we learn a little bit more about the blue light and Varun.
Yeah, I really love this chapter because we get some insight into the like soul body connection and how maybe necromancy works within the body. And then we also get a little bit of insight into Camilla and Palamity's relationship. But before all of that, there's an interesting kind of relationship dynamic that this early on in the book, we really don't understand, where Nona asks about Crown. So Crown is Corona Beth. And Nona is like, you know, I love Crown.
Right.
And Palamides is like, we don't really like Crown that much. And they have a back and forth about this. And Palamides asks Nona why she loves Crown.
Mm-hmm.
And Nona says Crown smells like cinnamon and her breasts feel nice when they hug. And of course, Palamides takes notes. I want, y'all, this is what I want. I want a short collection of stories that is just excerpts from Camilla and Palamides' notebook on all the things they write about in these first half of the book about Nona.
That could even be like an extra that they add on, like in the appendix of this book. I would not be surprised. I do think it's interesting. Pal asks how Nona knows what cinnamon smells like. And Nona's like, I just do.
Yeah.
And it's because she's the entire earth.
Yes.
I would love to get a little bit more information about what exactly went down that soured the relationship between, obviously it was already sort of tense in As Yet Unsent, but you know, I think it seems mostly that Crown's really gone hard Blood of Eden, and Blood of Eden is not being as supportive as Pal and Cam and Pyrrha would like, especially around the sixth house.
Yeah. So that was my interpretation of why they're all grumpy with each other right now, because the Blood of Eden has kidnapped Camilla and Palamity's family, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And Corona Beth is still gung-ho, rah-rah, Blood of Eden.
Right.
So I would be mad, too. It's kind of like if you get bullied and your best friend is friends with your bully and you're like, yo, what is this about?
And it's Mervwing that has the sixth house, but still, it's like they came in, they didn't know that, you know, their wing would have so little power, or, you know, not complete power once they were here on this planet.
Right.
This is also the bit that we get two incredible quotes. I think one especially is oft quoted in the fandom. But Palamity says, I can never stop you from loving anything. I don't have the right. Nobody has the right to tell you who to love and who not to love. And equally, nobody's obliged to love you. If you were forced into loving them, it wouldn't be love. Which, yeah.
Yeah.
But then there's the big one. And I feel like, what does Tamsin Muir, like, what does she say about how we haven't even begun to see the whatever that love can do?
Mm-hmm. Like the destruction.
Yeah. And this is kind of a similar vibe. Palamity says, being unexpectedly loved is so wonderful or terrible, isn't it? Which is like such a, I mean, we could really dig into that, but we won't.
we'll circle back towards the end of the chapter, because there's a few more things that happen. I think what we're all thinking, I'll just say it, what we're all thinking when Palamity says this is like, are you projecting something about your relationship with Camilla here?
Mm.
And, you know, time will tell. But I love these quotes. I also just love how Palamides interacts with Nona. It's so sweet.
Mm-hmm.
He's so pure-hearted. And you're like, I want Palamides to be my family.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Like, he's so great. He's exactly the kind of parent you would want for someone like Nona. Not that it's like parent-child necessarily, but like caregiver, we'll say. He's such a good caregiver.
Yeah, and he's very patient and like he answers all her questions as best he can. Nona starts to ask some questions about the blue light, so Varun, the resurrection beast. And we'll see this a lot later in the book, but it really, really hurts necromancers. It basically drives them insane. The same way that it drove the lictors insane if they were in their bodies.
Right.
And Nona asks if the light will start to hurt Camilla or Pyrrha. And this is a great way for us to get a little bit of exposition on how this works. And the deal is basically the soul. The soul is the thing that's driven mad.
Well, it's complicated. Like, the breakdown that I took away from this, because the way that Palamedes explains it to Camilla is basically like the blue light doesn't hurt Pyrrha because Pyrrha has the wrong body but the correct soul. And then, which we know that Pyrrha's body is Gideon's body, who was a necromancer. But Pyrrha's soul is now in Gideon's body, and so, and she is not a necromancer. But then, you know, with Camilla and Palamedes, it's flipped, where we're in Camilla's body, who is does not have a necromantic body, but Palamedes' soul is necromantic. And so what I kind of took away from this is that it sounds like a necromantically inclined soul can actually trigger necromantic biological processes within a physical body. So for example, if Palamedes' soul inhabits Camilla's body for too long, it changes something in the physical body that makes it so the resurrection beast impacts the body. On the flip side, it also sounds like the reverse is true. So, you know, with Pyrrha, a formerly necromantic body with a non-necromantic soul maybe loses the biological necromancy that was there. It doesn't explain why Pyrrha's body is seemingly indestructible and unaffected by the resurrection beast. So, for example, I think later on we get a reference to Pyrrha chugging
bleach,
and it doesn't, it basically has the effect of just giving her really bad hangover.
I think it gave her hiccups.
It gave her hiccups, you know. And so it's not like there's clearly something that is still, you know, in position in Gideon's body that is keeping Pyrrha's body indestructible. But whatever made it necromantic is not at least strong enough that the resurrection beast is impacting it. Anyway, very interesting.
It seems like the soul is what is necromantic, but you kind of have to have like the right, you have to have the soul and then also the necromantic OG body for the resurrection beast to affect you in this way.
Unless you're Palamedes and you're inhabiting Camilla's body for too long. And then it changes. But anyway, I do think it does seem that the soul is where the necromancy lives. I don't know.
Well, then we get to hear a little bit about We Suffer. I think at the audiobook, this is the first time that we ever hear We Suffer speak. So the first time we ever hear We Suffer's incredible French accent. Which is really the part I remember most from this section from my first listen.
Definitely. Thank you, Moira Quirk, for that one.
I think when I heard it first, I said, what? Nona likes We Suffer because We Suffer once gave her a treat.
That is. That's as far as it goes. We also are told here that Blood of Eden does want Nona. Like, they think that Nona will get them something. We don't really know what that's about yet.
I think they mostly want Nona. They want Harrow. They want a lictor, right?
Yeah. They want a lictor, and they think that Nona is a lictor. In fact, Nona's not a lictor. She is something even far more valuable.
Well, in a way, she's a lictor. She's a perfect lictor with Jod.
But
in the wrong body.
But Blood of Eden doesn't know that.
No one does.
I mean, Pyrrha has suspicions, but
I did think it was interesting that Nona says that the sweet that We Suffer gave her ended up being too sweet. That sounded very Harrow-like. I mean, but also Nona doesn't like food either. But I thought it was interesting that Nona does seem to share with Harrow kind of a lack of passion about food.
Definitely. Those are like the one qualities of both of them that I don't love. I'm like, I love all food. Give it to me. All the flavors. yeah. make it tasty. And Harrow's like, gross.
Exactly. And then there's this bit that is so interesting, and I don't really know what to think about it. So I'd love if people have thoughts about this, please send them in, because I was a little bit thrown off by when Nona says to Palamedes, she says, sometimes I don't like it when you do the necromancy word, LOL, but it feels nice at the same time. It's mixed up. It's like when you do that, it makes me sad, not sad that you did it, but sad that you can do it. So I don't really, so Nona is Alecto, the sort of embodiment of Earth and like the souls of the destroyed Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And also presumably the person who, or like the entity that originally gave Jod his powers.
Mm-hmm.
So does she not like necromancy because she like wishes that it had never had to, it didn't have to come to this?
Yeah, you know, I've read this over a few different times because I'm not totally sure. I think where I landed with it, and this is also probably a passage that we will revisit once we finish mm-hmm. the fourth and final book.
Right.
I think that Nona gave Jod necromancy, not Nona, Alecto gave Jod necromancy with the intention of helping him save the world. And instead, what he did with it was destroy the world. Mm-hmm. And so part of me feels like that's the feeling here, mm-hmm. maybe, that she's having some sort of bodily memory of when Jod murdered billions of people and mm-hmm. destroyed all the planets in the solar system.
Yeah.
Because she says it's sad that you can do it. So I, yeah.
And she also says it feels nice at the same time. So I don't really know what that's about. It doesn't make her think of John, who she does love. I don't know. So let us know if you have thoughts, but we'll come back to that if we have better ideas as we get farther into the book. But it is an interesting little tidbit.
Yeah. And then as we kind of close out the chapter, we did want to end with some thoughts around Camilla and Palamedes' relationship, just from some of the passages here. We get so many questions from our listeners, of course, about what we think about the nature of Camilla and Palamedes' relationship.
Yeah, more than any other relationship, I think.
Right. And I think because it is like a little bit ambiguous, for some people, they feel that it's really obvious in one direction. For other people, they feel like it's really obvious in another. Mm-hmm. And so we're obvious. So much of this book is about Camilla and Palamedes' relationship. And so this will be a continuous conversation throughout the entire Nona the Ninth reread. Mm-hmm. But right here is just a really beautiful and heartbreaking passage
mm-hmm.
through a conversation that Nona is having with Palamedes, and then also through a memory that Nona talks about,
mm-hmm.
about the two of them. That is really beautiful.
Yeah. Because early in the chapter, there was that bit where she's asking if the blue light will start hurting Camilla, and he says no. And she says she doesn't want anything to hurt Camilla because she loves Camilla. And Palamedes asks, why do you love Camilla? And she says, I love the way... Well, she's struggling. She's like, how do you... sum up my like infinite love for Camilla.
Right.
Same.
I mean,
but she ends up on, I love the way she moves. And he says, me too. And Nona says, do you miss seeing her? And he says, dreadfully, but the recordings are nice. So it is, I mean, it could totally be read as romantic, but it also.
It doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be at all.
Yeah. However, towards the end of the chapter, then it becomes even the waters become even more muddied
mm-hmm.
because as Palamedes is leaving Nona, he leaves Nona with a kiss on her hand to give Camilla. The description of this is really well done. Tamsin writes, and he spread Nona's fingers like he always did, and he quietly kissed the second right-hand knuckle. Nona always paid so much more attention to the lessons of the hand and the mouth than she did to the lessons of the bones and the sword. So pretty,
I know.
The way that's written.
And she remembers that the first time that Palamedes did this, and she had given Camilla this kiss, Camilla had gone to sit in the bath by herself for almost an hour.
And then, oh my God, and the chapter closes with, now when Nona waited for Camilla's eyes to clear and she lifted up Camilla's hand to press her mouth to it, all Camilla said was, thanks. And she almost didn't flinch. And you know what this reminded me of? This, the end of this chapter, like that line reminded mm-hmm. me of the last line in the study of the mysterious study of Dr. Sex, mm-hmm. where like it's almost written with the same cadence. Mm-hmm. But at the very end of that short story, Tamsin writes that Palamedes like remembers what was written on that paper because he never forgets anything he sees. And mm-hmm. then I think it ends with something like, and that was my problem coming from Camilla's perspective. I mm-hmm. never forget him or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think, okay, right now in this moment, I will say anyone can read this in any way that they want. And there's mm-hmm. not like one right way to read this. I genuinely feel that in this moment, this feels very romantic to me.
Yeah, I think I feel like it's romantic. But I don't think we get a lot of people writing in and saying that they feel that Camilla is ace. And I feel like I'm pretty on board with that. But I do feel like Camilla and Pal's relationship it's like platonic and romantic, even though like I will read that fan fiction until the day I die. I don't think their relationship is or ever was or would be sexual, but I do feel like their bond is like so much farther beyond that it is romantic. So that's kind of where I land.
We should clarify what ace means, because I feel like some people who are listening might actually not know. Ace means like asexual. It's like shorthand for asexual. But I don't think that means that Camilla isn't aromantic. I mean, and who knows? Like I'm on board with Camilla being ace too. I feel like I read that that reads really clear to me. I still think that this is a romantic love.
Yeah, I've read some fan fiction that basically the whole premise is after the events of Canaan House, Palamedes kind of realizes that actually he loved Camilla all along, and like that was the relationship that he was missing, and like then they all somehow come back and they all bang. I'm so into that, but I think actually though it's well, I don't know. I don't know about this. I feel like a lot firmer about my beliefs on pretty much every other like pairing of people.
Yeah, totally. But this one does feel ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And I think that's intentional on Tamsin Muir's part. Mm-hmm. I feel like with all the relationships, she kind of leaves them open to interpretation. And I don't think this is any different than that.
Yeah, and what I love about Tamsin Muir's writing about relationships is that she's not like, oh, you know, you either are like dating someone and you have like a sexual romantic, like that's what you have, or you are just buds, or you're like enemies. It's like all tangled up. And I know also that like a lot of this is kind of similar to the way relationships are portrayed in Homestuck. So I'm so excited for our Homestuck episode.
Yeah,
where
totally.
We'll get to explore that.
Let's move on. We have two more chapters that we're covering in this episode, and they're both so good.
I know. Chapter 6 is mostly just Nona getting a bedtime story. Oh, I mean, I feel like the juicy bit is Nona gets a bedtime story from Camilla. Mm-hmm. But it starts with Pyrrha working late that evening. Nona's having a bath. And one thing that Camilla says that was interesting to me is she asks Nona if she would ever want to leave here. Nona says no, and then asks if there's anything that Nona isn't telling her. And Nona says yes. And a couple things. First of all, I think it's interesting because I feel like her first question implies that at this point, Camilla is actually considering Pyrrha's offer to sort of take them away to like homestead on a planet, basically. And I also love that when Nona says that she's, you know, keeping some stuff from Camilla and Palamedes, Camilla doesn't ask her what it is.
Yeah.
But just ask Nona to let her and Palamedes know if there's anything that scares her, right?
It is such a good, again, like I'm going to be a new parent in a number of months. And I just feel like I've taken lessons from Camilla and Palamedes. The way that they allow for Nona to consent to everything and to share or not share, as long as it's not causing harm to other people. Mm-hmm. I just think that's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's really cool. This is also another hint that we later learn, basically, that Nona has a couple secrets. First of all, that she can hear the blue light sing Varun. She can kind of communicate with Varun. Mm-hmm. And then also she knows that she's dying. So those are some, if maybe all of the secrets that she's keeping from Cam and Pal.
Yeah. And, you know, she's keeping some secrets from herself, too.
Mm, true.
But yeah, before we get into the juiciest bits of this chapter, there is like a meme alert here that is just so fucking funny. And beep, beep, beep. And basically, like, as Nona is in the bath, Camilla is reading her kind of like a Dear Annie section of the newspaper where people write in with their problems and then someone answers. Uh-huh. And the quote in the book is, "Dear Auntie, when my boyfriend and I got into an argument, he goes to the bathroom and makes me apologize to ... And Tamsin like cuts it off there. But this is an original reference from the original reference is a tweet from Gabrielle Moss back in 2019. And she's kind of referring to the things like the "Am I an asshole?" on Reddit thread. And Gabrielle Moss tweets, "Why is every Reddit relationships question like, I, female 29, love my fiance, male 34, except whenever we fight, he takes a dump in the living room, then makes me refer to his dump as Mr. Hoskins and apologize to it. Am I overreacting? Our wedding is in 6 hours."
I had totally forgotten about this tweet until you actually pointed out that this is, and I don't know why I didn't realize that this is what the reference was to, but so freaking funny.
It's so funny. Oh my God. It's so funny. We don't get that many memes and references in Nona, like not as much as we do in the other books. And but when we do get them, they are bangers. And yeah, this is one.
So after that, Nona and Cam are having a hard time going to sleep, and Cam asks if she should read another of these Dear Aunties. And Nona asks for a bedtime story instead, and in fact asks for the story of when Cam met her, which is very convenient for us.
very convenient for us. Although as I was reading this, I was remembering that I feel like I asked my parents to tell the story of me being born when I was little. So I thought this was pretty cute.
Yeah, it is cute. So we should just go kind of through this story, I guess, beat by beat, because there's so much.
Yes. And what we are learning here is the sum of the events that happened between the end of Harrow the Ninth and the beginning of this book.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting some blanks filled in.
Right. Yeah, it's very, very helpful. So first of all, Cam says they met when the warden saved you after you were hurt, and that was the first time that he showed that he could do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this refers to the warden saving Harrow's body when that bit in that last part of Harrow the Ninth, when Gideon is in Harrow's body in the river, watching Ianthe save Jod from the stoma, and their kind of chest crushes in from the weight of the river around them. And
right. And Gideon in Harrow's body is with Pyrrha in that moment.
Right. So Palamedes saved the two of them either in the river or through Camilla, but I assume somehow in the river.
Yeah, we don't get like the details, because the other weird thing about the timing here is the next beat of this says, "At the time, we knew you were in trouble. You'd disappeared. We'd been trying to get you. We found you in Pyrrha. You were hurt." And so it could have been in that moment, like as that is going down, that somehow Palamedes and Camilla found them. Or it could have been a little bit after that. And so the timing is like a little suspect. But then Camilla says, Pyrrha helped us escape from an attack.
Yeah. Oh, one thing I wanted to say is, yeah, do you remember when you were talking about the wrong voice twice removed?
Oh, yeah, right.
So this is kind of this is a confirmation. So basically what happened is that when Gideon, the last thing that Gideon sees is Electo, but the voice that is speaking is Camilla's, but it's Pal's.
Correct. Right. That's right.
Whatever intonation or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what it means by twice removed. So I think this was the first time that I don't think that they've been able to sort of switch, like go in and out of each other's bodies yet. But basically, I feel like Pal somehow worked through Camilla to save Hera's body, which at the time had Gideon in it, but was crossing Gideon and Electo were sort of crossing each other as Electo entered the body. It was, I mean.
Totally.
So that's totally. So that kind of confirms what you were saying about that
right.
in the last book. Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. And so maybe timing wise, it actually did happen like right then and there. Mm-hmm. Like this happened right at the end of Hera.
Right.
So Camilla goes on to say, Pyrrha helped us escape from an attack. We lost people, ships, something very important. So someone wrote in it at one point, I think it was a question from Ellen. And then actually, as I was going through our inbox, there were a couple other people that also had the same question. But Ellen writes, she can't find any explanation as to how God comes into possession of Gideon's body. Right. And so this is kind of a question that a lot of us have around, like, how did Jod end up with Gideon's body? Because we know Gideon's body was with Blood of Eden. And so what this bit seems to suggest, at least I think you and I, both of us agree on the interpretation of this, is that there's something very important that Palamedes, Camilla, Pyrrha, and the rest of Blood of Eden lost is Gideon's body. In this kind of kerfuffle with, I think, Jod and Ianthe.
Right. So I think probably what happened is the Warden and Cam and Blood of Eden and all of them save Harrow's body from the river. Harrow's pretty much gone, like knocked out. So not in commission. They also have Gideon's body. Very soon after that, I feel like they are attacked probably by God and Ianthe.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to escape with Pyrrha's help, but in the battle, they lost Gideon's body.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's what my interpretation of this is.
So that's when I would bet all of my meager savings on on this being the moment where they lost. The something very important is Gideon's body.
Yep.
Yep.
Thanks for writing in with that question, Ellen, and everyone else. But that's our take on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after this attack, things kind of calm down a little bit. There is some disagreement within Blood of Eden around whether or not they want to keep Nona, whether or not they're going to keep Pyrrha alive.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it is decided that they are going to hold on to Nona and they are going to let Pyrrha live. And I think the quote here is that Nona says, everyone paid attention to We Suffer, who said, I trust them. They will not betray us. And Camilla responds, yes, back when We Suffer trusted us, We Suffer even let Pyrrha live. Pyrrha talked fast.
This is surprising to me because basically We Suffer knows that Pyrrha killed Wake, who was kind of her idol and boss and like leader. But as we've seen, Pyrrha is a fast talker and very charming. And I also think probably there was a part of We Suffer that was like, if my boss, you know, had this thing with this person, which I imagine maybe she didn't know. Actually, she probably wouldn't know.
But Pyrrha, I think, tells them. This is why. So my theory is that they let Pyrrha live because Pyrrha was like, I am Wake's lover. And everyone was like, oh, damn, if you're Wake's lover, then there must be something to you. I don't know. It is very interesting how willing We Suffer is to work with these people who represent the houses.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, she also was coming from a place where her boss, Wake, was, I assume she knew that her boss was working with lictors to try and accomplish their ends. So it's not like she was the first person ever to be like, maybe we should try and bring some of these people to our side. It's she's kind of following Wake's example.
Totally. I mean, and Mercy, they've worked with Mercy Morn already.
Right.
So, you know, there is precedent here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Camilla says, then I found a way for the warden to come back. That was a relief. And this is a little bit confusing to me because this implies that when the warden saved Harrow's body, he wasn't functioning in the way, like in Camilla's body, the way he is now. So I don't really know like what the difference was or like how exactly he saved them without. But anyway, the point is here that at this is the moment where they learn that they can sort of share the same body as long as, you know, he isn't in Camilla's body for too long. And that's how they're able to do the rest of the stuff that they talk about, that Camilla talks about in this story.
Right. And so when Palamedes comes back, he wants to evoke the break clause. And Camilla says, which means he wanted his family away from the houses. So the break clause, I think we talk about this maybe in our Nona initial reaction episode, but the break clause is some sort of like Cassiopeia lawyer shit where, you know, we know that Cassiopeia was a lawyer pre-resurrection and she built something into the like legal contract of the sixth house that allows them to break away. And also, very cool, the warden, of course, convinces the oversight body to actually do this, to evoke the break clause. And they, I had a question about this. Camilla says, we showed them the secret of the installation. Is that the warden and Camilla showed the oversight body that the installation was actually a spaceship and could leave or what?
Yeah, that's what I thought. And yeah, that this was kind of like the secret that Cassiopeia had built into the sixth house, that it's basically a giant spaceship that can physically leave.
Right.
But they needed a number of very large steelies.
Yeah, in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they did do it. And so they moved the sixth house installation. We don't really know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think throughout the whole book, we are not sure where it is. But then Palamedes chooses 16 people to talk with Blood of Eden to discuss the future. So like maybe broker peace, like between the sixth house and Blood of Eden, or like figure out how they're going to work together.
Mm-hmm. Then Camilla talks about Nona waking up. So she says, you were waking up, you met me for the first time. And Nona asks her, what did you think of me? Is this a question it seems like she's asked many times before, but Camilla says, I thought I didn't know you at all. You were new. And it says, Nona always loved this answer unreasonably. The idea that was when Camilla met her, that was her birth. And I find this interesting for a couple of reasons. I think partially because it kind of feels like this is the part of Nona that really doesn't want to be Electo, and like the relief of being like, oh, I'm someone totally new. I don't have to be that. I can be this sort of new, pure thing that doesn't have all that history. And also, I think it's interesting because I think I thought that this book was like literally exactly 6 months after the very end of Harrow the Ninth. But I think that this implies that there was some amount of time. It might have been a short amount of time in between, but probably not a short amount of time in between the end of Harrow the Ninth and the birth of Nona.
Yeah.
So actually this book takes place more than 6 months after the end of Harrow, and up to maybe even a year after the end of Harrow. Who knows how long Nona was kind of, that Harrow's body was kind of just like
chilling.
Yeah.
With no conscious soul to move it around.
But this implies that basically before Nona wakes up and after Harrow the Ninth, a ton of stuff happens, including some fight with Jod and Ianthe where they get Gideon's body, or it could have been with a cohort, but anyway, and all of this sort of working with Blood of Eden and moving the sixth house. Like a lot of stuff happens before Nona sort of is born.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reminded of an interview that Tamsin gave on a podcast called Voyage to Genre. And she talks about how, like, in plays, there's a lot of action that happens off the stage. And mm-hmm. as a writer, you have to decide, like, what is happening off the stage, like what story is happening off the stage and what story is happening on it. And right. this is like a very clear use of that.
Right.
Or reflection of that. And it's fun because it gives us things to speculate about. And we get a story. And there's so much in this story that, like, if we got every little detail, it would be too much.
Right.
And so it's really cool, I think, how the story of what happened between the end of Harrow and the beginning of Nona is told in this very abbreviated way, but we can infer so much from it.
Right, right. So they go on to talk about, Camilla goes on to talk about how they lived here. So on this planet, in this apartment, and then things went horribly wrong. And what had gone wrong is that the light appeared. So Varun showed up, and then also they found out that Blood of Eden had lied to us. Or Camilla says, or at least didn't have the power to look after us anymore. So Varun appearing is self-explanatory. But I think that this must be when they kind of realized that their wing of Blood of Eden wasn't necessarily like in charge. Like they mm-hmm. were in sort of this political, ideological feud with at least one other wing of Blood of Eden.
Yeah.
That kind of push and pull left Camilla and Pyrrha and Nona very vulnerable.
Totally. And in fact, in As Yet Unsent, Judith, you know, Judith predicts this,
right.
I think, in her writing. She's like, yo, I don't know that We Suffer can protect us. And, you know, she was right.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when Varun shows up, my theory, and I don't have much to back this, just kind of in the language that's used here around things went wrong and that had been a hideous time,
uh-huh.
was I imagine that when Varun showed up might have been when the Sixth House was kidnapped. The Sixth House oversight body was kidnapped
right.
by Merv Wing. And I also think it might have been the beginning of the burnings of necromancers because you can't necessarily tell who is a necromancer. I mean, obviously, their bodies are a lot weaker, and so there's some indication there. But you can't really tell who is a necromancer. But when the resurrection beast shows up, you can tell.
Right. Because, that's a good point.
And so I almost wonder if, like, that's when the kind of this new planet that was already, like, too overpopulated and not doing too well, but when everything kind of went to shit and it became more of a war zone.
Right. Right. And Nona asks why the Sixth House left, basically. And Camilla says that they didn't feel like they could be there anymore, not until they really understood what they were doing morally, and that they made promises that they ended up not being able to keep. And you can tell, it's never really explicitly stated, but you can tell that Camilla, Palamedes, and I think especially Camilla, are really torn up about the fact that they kind of made this promise that they would be able to move the Sixth House and like work with Blood of Eden and all would be well or whatever they said. And obviously now everything's gone to shit. The Sixth House has been kidnapped. God is after them. Like, it's obviously really, really wearing on Camilla.
Yeah. I mean, it would wear on me if I pulled my whole family into this situation. But it closes, you know, with they close out this conversation and, you know, Nona starts to fall asleep and then Pyrrha comes home. And it is this really cute little closing picture of a very domestic little family where Pyrrha comes in and is like, hi, says uh-huh. all this cute shit. And Camilla's like, go to bed. I just got her to sleep. And so right. we get this like really intense story. And then it's also juxtaposed, like, it's right next to this very, like, boring little, cute little domestic image.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought it was a good ending to the chapter.
Mm-hmm. And then we get to our second John chapter, and this will close out day one. So this is John 5:20. The letters that these numbers correspond to are E and T. So we've got the now spelled out, and the next word starts with a T, what could it be? And Harrow / Alecto and John are standing on a hill overlooking a plain in this bit. It kind of is described as, it seems like maybe a place where a bomb went off, because there's a bunch of rubble sort of on the outskirts of this sort of hollowed out plain area. It's also interesting because it reminded me, and I didn't really go researching this at all, but Armageddon, the last battle in the Book of Revelation in the Bible, is supposed to kind of take place on a big plain, and there is like a hill overlooking it. There's something about kind of this setup. I don't know if this was purposeful, but maybe it was.
It's also, the way this is described is kind of interesting, because the narrator says, at the bottom of the hill, there was a great swept out plain as though somebody had cupped their hand over the landscape and scraped everything to one side, like filth off a table. And later on, when John describes him finally killing off everyone, the imagery is of a big, like, kind of hand that is reaching out and just killing everyone.
Right.
And so that's sort of hinted at here a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. We learn in this bit kind of about the beginning of John's necromancy and how their project is getting shut down. So,
yes. So, you know, John is telling this, he's telling it in kind of like a flippant way, as he is wont to do. But essentially, the royal they are shutting down the project. And so John's project being creating all of these, you know, cryo cans that are going to take the whole population off the planet for a little while. And he and his team have been experimenting to make sure that people's bodies can actually be preserved in these things.
Right.
And so they've been doing experimentation on them, but the project is getting shut down, and then that is leaked to the public, and the public basically goes bonkers. Like, as you can imagine, they have been maybe in denial that that the impacts of climate change are this dire. But in any case, John describes it as, like, people are just now all of a sudden, like, panicking about this. And so the economy tanks. And then not only is the public panicking, but Augustine is, Cassiopeia is, Mercy Morn is, and it's just kind of a shit show.
This is also the bit where we find out that Cassiopeia is actually dating who will be her cavalier post-apocalypse, Nigella. I think it's funny because they refuse to admit they're dating, which, I don't know, whatever.
So gay.
I know.
And they all know, like, Jod's like, we all knew they were dating, and yet they didn't think that we knew.
Right.
But a big issue is that because the project is going to be shut down, they have to find a way to dispose of all of the dead bodies that they've been experimenting on. And this is, of course, like a major biohazard.
Right. And John is really bothered by this because these bodies, he's been experimenting on them for so long that he feels like he kind of knows them, like, personally, and, like, loves them.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
He's a weird guy. We also get our first mention of Pyrrha in pre-resurrection setting, where we learn that Pyrrha was a cop and happens to be buddies with Gideon, who happens to be Jod's, like, childhood friend. And so because Gideon and Jod are really close, and because Pyrrha is really close with Gideon, Pyrrha as a cop is able to, like, I think the quote is, keep the heat down.
Right. This is where the project gets leaked.
Yeah. And I mean, like, as this, like, public panic is happening, the way that John is describing this is like, you know, we already worked through all the potential solutions, but now the public is working through them.
Right.
And so through this, we get to learn more about what Earth's space travel capabilities actually were back then.
Right.
And they were quite impressive.
Yeah. I feel like this gets kind of sci-fi-y here. It's like a bunch of stuff. I remember, Tau Ceti is in like a bunch of science fiction books.
Yes. There's reference to, says, what about the Mars installation? Like, what about the Kuiper platform? What about Uranus and the show we're building over there? Mm-hmm. So people throwing out all these ideas. I think the function of this for us is we can see that maybe there are actually people already living outside of Earth.
Right.
On some of these installations. So Mars being one of them. Something I found really interesting was the Kuiper platform, which I could be totally off here, but I have this sneaking suspicion that this might be where the ninth house originated. And that's because the Kuiper belt is a circumstellar disk in the outer solar system. Uh-huh. And so it basically like extends from the orbit of Neptune. It's similar to an asteroid belt, but it differs a little bit. And basically, Pluto is part of the Kuiper belt.
Right.
And so I don't know, but I feel like Tamsin is very intentional about the information that is shared. And so if in pre-resurrection time, there had been some sort of installation built out on the Kuiper, in the Kuiper belt, then perhaps that was actually on Pluto.
Right. Yeah. And that could have been the beginning of the ninth house.
Yeah. Right. So that was one thought. And then I think for those of the listeners who don't read maybe as much science fiction, we could share a little bit about what Tau Ceti is.
Well, I always understood it as just like it is a solar system that kind of looks a little bit like ours, that like people have thought maybe we could live there.
Yeah, it is. It's a Tau Ceti, I think, refers to an actual star.
Mm, right, right. Which is a lot like our sun.
Yeah, very similar to the sun. And there are apparently planets in that system. And as of like 2012, I was reading, they've been confirmed as super Earths that are orbiting that sun.
Right.
With two of them being potentially habitable. And so there have been plenty of science fiction authors who have taken this, obviously, and ran with it. One of them actually being Ursula Le Guin in The Dispossessed, which if you haven't read it, it's an interesting read and an interesting take on anarchy. But Ursula Le Guin just being one of many authors who have have played with that idea.
I'm reading it right now, which I thought was
very... Oh, you are?
Yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah, I read it with my book club. I'll be curious to hear what you think about it.
Yeah, so far loving it. But yeah, definitely like a very big like sci-fi sort of trope, like, you know. And sometimes sci-fi predicts the future. Like there is a world in which like we could potentially travel there and who knows?
Who knows?
But John is not really concerned with any of this. He is really just super concerned about the dead bodies that they're going to have to dispose of. And he, even though, you know, their funds have dried up and the project is being shut down, he continues to work with the bodies. Mm-hmm. And Mercy Morn especially is very nervous about this and is like, what is going on with you? You're on class A's, you're on amphetamines, you're on coke, you're on amphetamines and coke. Ugh. You should say the next bit, Mel, because...
All right, you be Mercy Morn and I'll be God. I'll be John.
You're on amphetamines. You're on coke. You're on amphetamines and coke.
I was all like, yeah, coke zero. She didn't laugh. I laughed, he said. I guess I've always thought any pun was automatically funny.
Wow. Okay, Gideon's dad.
I know. This is such a good callback to Gideon the ninth, where there is the exact same sentence where like Gideon always thought any pun was automatically funny. So
yeah,
that was enjoyable.
And they're kind of fighting. Cassiopeia is trying to delay them basically shutting the electricity off. And eventually it just comes to a head and they tell them that they're going to shut down the whole facility, basically lights off, you know, that night at like 6 p.m. And they don't have any time to really prepare.
So, of course, like it is inevitable, right, that the electricity is shutting down. John is upset, like we said, about disposing the bodies and not treating them with respect. And all his peeps are like, you crazy. except, and the only one who doesn't think John is crazy is Gideon.
Right.
Pre-resurrection Gideon. And I just think it's interesting how Gideon pre-resurrection compares to Gideon post-resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though he was resurrected without his pre-resurrection memories, his devotion to John is the same.
Right.
And so here, I think John says he was worrying Augustine and everyone else, but Gideon kept saying, I was fine.
Right.
He was the voice in the wilderness. Gideon always thought anything I did or said was fine. Not necessarily right, but fine.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, like, it's interesting what the pre-resurrection lictors brought with them into, brought of their personalities post-resurrection, despite not having memory.
Yeah, definitely. So when they shut down the electricity, they kind of expect all these bodies to just sort of immediately liquidize and super rot very quickly because they had no way to preserve them anymore. But John had had a couple of favorite corpses. And when they shut down, and he would literally like go around and tell them to hang on and... And when they shut him off, a lot of the corpses did liquefy very quickly, but the few that were John's favorites stayed, he says, incorrupti, so they do not rot. And that's kind of the beginning of necromancy.
Yeah, he doesn't realize he has that power yet. This is right. Like the first time that something is up.
Yeah, he's like, he does say like, I've got this. I know this. You know, I'm so close. And I think he's just very close to necromancy, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it is curious. Like, we don't know when the exact moment was that he is given necromancy by Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it.
Yeah, and that's the end of that chapter and the end of day one of Nona the Ninth. I think we do have a question or two that aren't really related.
Yeah. One of my really funny question that someone wrote in is in reference to, I don't know, like what episode we talked about this in, but she wrote, I am morbidly fascinated by the mention of a ladies sitting on cakes event happening at a regular mainstream bar. Oh, and I think it's even referenced here in Nona chapters. We talked about this during Nona, the chapters 1 through 2 episode. This person always thought it was made up. And so they want to know, Amy, what bar was that at?
I feel like I'm giving away my secrets, but if next time you're in Washington, D.C., go to Showtime on a Wednesday. It's Dyke Night. And you might see some ladies sitting on cakes.
So good.
I know. I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the greatest regrets of my life that I didn't go that night.
Maybe there will be another chance, hopefully.
Yeah, maybe.
The next question, or really, this is less of a question and more an observation.
Yeah, this was great.
Someone made, I fucking loved this. Yeah, this is one of my favorite write-ins, I think. This is from Alyssa. And Alyssa references how Amy and I are always kind of like arguing about whether Gideon and Arrow are in love or not, or is it romantic or not, et cetera, et cetera.
So this is from Alyssa. We're just going to read it because it's very cool and brilliant and...
And funny.
And funny. And we loved it. Okay. So while Gideon and Arrow are fighting Kithorea, Gideon falls on the fence after they high-key pour their hearts out to each other, but it's all like an allusion to Greek myth. Kithorea is another name for Aphrodite, which fucking tracks when you consider both people are fawning over her and the adjacency of Aphrodite to war. You know who else is connected to Aphrodite / Kithorea? Cupid, Eros.
Bam!
Who shoots people with arrows through the heart and then they fall in love. So back to chapter 37. Hera and Gideon start showing how much they care for each other in front of Kithorea Aphrodite, and then Gideon sacrifices herself for Hera by falling on a spiked fence through the heart. She literally gets shot, stabbed through the heart by this fence in front of someone named Aphrodite, and then Hera is heartbroken and realizes all of her feelings for Gideon. So that's my unhinged sapphic theory. Hope it's not too feral gay conspiracy theory for this podcast. No, it's not, Alyssa.
Never. Keep them coming.
I loved that. I loved that.
Me too. And I'm like, I have decided this is truth. This is canon for me. This was meant to be here. I mean, this is great.
Wow. So did it take Alyssa to get you on board, Mel?
No, I've come around. I've talked about it. I think they truly love each other. Do I think it's sexual? I don't know. The jury is still out. Of course, I think they love each other. And I do believe it's romantic. I feel like I've said that before. I'll say it again.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying, I feel like this is actually kind of saying that it's kind of like in love, like in a super sexy way. But thank you, Alyssa, so much for that. We loved getting your message. And I think it's brilliant. And I love how deep people go in these books. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
All right. I think that's about it for this episode. Ooh, thanks so much for joining us. If you have questions or comments or incredible gay theories about the characters, please send us a question on our website, locktombpod.com, or on Twitter at locktombpod. If you liked this podcast, tell all your friends to listen or rate and review us wherever you listen. Your support means so much to us, and we can't thank you enough. Thanks as always to Olivia Kay for our theme music. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
And we'll see you next time here at the Locktomb Podcast.